Today is Friday, January 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick in Washington. Coming up, we look at the events of the past 24 hours in which a US airstrike killed a leading Iranian general.
They will not stop doing that just because their leader has died. They'll put another guy in. But Soleimani was more effective because he had so much success. People started to view him as having some sort of an aura about him. That aura is punctured.
Also ahead, Australia's bushfires continue to rage, and North Korea has yet to deliver its promised Christmas present to the United States. It's all on today's International Edition. In our top story at this hour, the United States has struck a significant and potentially risky blow against Iran, killing the leader of that nation's elite Quds force in an airstrike in Iraq. The Pentagon confirmed the death of Quds force commander General Qasem Soleimani late Thursday, saying the strike was launched, quote, at the direction of U.S. President Donald Trump. It further described the strike as a, quote, decisive defensive action to protect U.S. personnel abroad. The Defense Department statement shared few details of the strike itself, but Iraqi officials said a rocket struck a convoy traveling near Baghdad International Airport late Thursday. Iran says it considers Soleimani's killing an act of war and has promised it will seek revenge against the United States. Now, earlier I spoke to VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Selden. I asked him whether Iran has the capability or the will to go to all-out war with the U.S.
Most analysts and onlookers and even intelligence officials will tell you that the conventional wisdom is that Iran does not want all-out direct war with the United States. That is a type of conflict that does not play to Iran's advantage. It does not have the kind of firepower that will match up well with the United States in what would be a direct conflict. But that's never really how Iran tends to operate. Counterintelligence officials will say that, and counterterrorism officials say that what Iran excels at is these asymmetric techniques, using proxy forces, using attacks where you might not expect them, using cyber and other methods to put pressure and to attack and even kill U.S. and Western personnel, attack Western assets in a way that plays to the strengths that Iran has, and that is it has a very significant, a very well-run network across much of the Middle East and beyond. Remember, when we're talking about the IRGC and the Quds Force, which Qasem Soleimani ran, you're talking about an organization that ran external operations from Argentina to Bulgaria. Even there were plots that Hezbollah and other Iranian-linked groups have tried to carry out in the United States. How might they use that to get at the U.S. and other Western nations? Will they try to seize more ships and tie up shipping and naval lanes in the Strait of Hormuz, which could affect the global economy? What else might they do? And that's the big concern, not a direct conflict, but an indirect conflict that could slowly or perhaps quickly spiral out of control.
How does this, all of this now, affect America's position on the ground in Iraq?
Well, it makes the American presence on the ground in Iraq and in Syria somewhat precarious. Remember, Qasem Soleimani has been able to travel almost at will through Iraq, through Syria. He also goes to Lebanon, where Iran has very close ties with Lebanese Hezbollah. And U.S. defense officials have been saying that it was Qasem Soleimani who actually orchestrated and ordered the attacks by the militia, Qataib Hezbollah, in Iraq on U.S. bases. And one of those attacks, the most recent, 31 rockets launched at a base where American forces were stationed. A U.S. contractor was killed, and that's what prompted this. So already there were concerns about U.S. security. There were concerns about the security of the embassy in Baghdad. Marines were sent in to shore up the embassy's security, and the U.S. days ago sent 750 troops from the 82nd Airborne Division into Kuwait so that they would be better positioned to help protect U.S. personnel and assets throughout the region. For as many people on the streets of Iraq and perhaps even in Iran who may be celebrating Qasem Soleimani's death, there may be just as many, if not more, who are very much supportive of what he was doing, of the groups that he supported, and may very well be seeking revenge.
Jeff, are you hearing anything about what this means for Iraq's security?
When you have officials like Qasem Soleimani traveling at will throughout Iraq, working with the paramilitary units that are supported and almost beholden to Iran, even though they're part of the Iraqi military and police infrastructure, you have a lot of questions about what politicians are willing to do and what some of these units are willing to do in terms of standing up to Iranian influence and drawing a line. How many politicians in Iraq are going to want to have to choose between Iran and the U.S.? Some of them have already chosen, and their allegiances are clear. Others may feel like they're between a rock and a hard place. So there's a lot of questions about how this will play out and how far the Iraqi caretaker government is willing to go to stand up to either side.
VOA's Jeff Seldon at the Pentagon, thank you so much for your time and thanks for talking to us.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Well, Soleiman was a key part of Iran's efforts to build influence across the Middle East, especially in Lebanon, Yemen, Syria, and Iraq. Many regional experts think the U.S. strike that killed him may have much broader impact on tensions in the Middle East. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi spoke with Professor David Deroche of the National Defense University for a look at the implications of the attack.
Well, Iran generally doesn't respond directly. It responds indirectly in a disruptive manner, often using proxies or other means that make it hard to attribute to Iran so that it would be hard to retaliate. So I think what we'll see is disruption at sea, things like scattering naval mines in the Strait of Hormuz. We'll see proxy attacks against Western interests by Iranian-directed militias in Lebanon, such as Hezbollah, possibly in Syria, in Iraq, by Khatib al-Hezbollah, whose command also died in the attack, maybe in Yemen. We might see terrorist attacks further afield. The Iranians tried to blow up a restaurant in central Washington, D.C. and kill the Saudi ambassador years ago. So there's the possibility of attacks overseas. And then the Iranians will take hostages, students or people, dual nationals in Iran, Western correspondents in Lebanon, Syria, or Iraq. They've been doing this for decades, and this is all part of their playbook. So there will be a response, but it won't be a direct military confrontation.
Iran has already proved its sophisticated capabilities in attacking Saudi oil installations and got away with its attack. Would that be an option to affect the oil market?
It could be, but I don't think they would do the same thing twice. The Iranian attack against the Abqaiq refineries was supposed to be unattributable. And the fact that it was attributed back to them so quickly, and that the Western allies, who Iran had been relying on to moderate the United States maximum pressure campaign, the fact that they immediately said this is an Iranian attack, it's unacceptable, that was a severe setback for Iran. And that actually was a benefit of Trump's restraint in not responding militarily to it. So I think they've realized that that's not a starter for them, that won't help them achieve their interests. What's more likely is that they do things to try to disrupt tankers by things such as scattering naval mines.
Could the killing of General Soleimani lead to a military confrontation between the U.S. and Iran, especially if Iran attacked U.S. bases or installations in the region?
Yes, it could. I don't think it'll be a direct confrontation. I don't think you'll see regular units of the Iranian army or the Revolutionary Guard squaring off against American bases. But what you will see are rockets, mortar fire, low-level harassment attacks against American positions and against American diplomatic facilities and against commercial interests like oil companies or airlines in the region. You might also see things that are difficult to attribute, like a random surface-to-air missile attacks on Western airliners in Africa, the Middle East, Europe, maybe even the United States.
Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden said President Trump threw dynamite on an explosive barrel in the Middle East. What's your take on that?
Yeah, that's a common view among Democrats. I think, though, it remains to be seen what will happen. The administration has said that Soleimani and Abdulmahdi al-Mohandas were planning an action against American interests. It could have been something as big as a mass hostage seizure like the Iranian seizure of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in 1979. That killed President Carter's presidency. If information comes out that they were trying to do something like this, then Biden will probably have to walk those words back. We'll see in a few days whether he is ahead of us or behind us. We don't know, but we will in a few weeks.
Would the killing of Soleimani reduce the Iranian efforts to expand the Iranian revolution into different areas in the Middle East?
Not as much as people think. It will rein back Iran's efforts just because Soleimani had been come to be seen as a charismatic figure who was really untouchable. you know, Iran has a policy of trying to expand its influence, trying to subvert governments that are weak, that have large Shia populations. And so we've seen that, you know, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Iraq, in Syria. They will not stop doing that just because their leader has died. They'll put another guy in. But Soleimani was more effective because he had so much success. People started to view him as having some sort of an aura about him. That aura is punctured. That will be a setback for Iran. What's more significant was the death of Abdelmadi al-Muhandis, the leader of Kattab Hezbollah, a local Iraqi Shia militia that took its orders from Soleimani. He had operated with impunity in Iraq and was actually incorporated into the Iraqi government. The fact that he died shows people who are considering aligning themselves with Iran, throwing their lot in with Revolutionary Guard, that there will be consequences to that action.
And that was Professor David Darosh of the National Defense University here in Washington, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. Now, of course, Iran has condemned the attack that killed General Soleimani.
I'm Mike Gracia reporting. Iran's president says the U.S. violated human rights and international law with the strike that killed a top Iranian general. Iran's president Hassan Rouhani is calling the killing of a Revolutionary Guard commander by the U.S. a heinous crime. In a tweet, Rouhani said the great nation of Iran will take revenge for the U.S. airstrike that killed General Qasem Soleimani, the head of Iran's elite Quds force near Baghdad's airport. Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has declared 3 days of public mourning for the general's death. In Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office says Netanyahu is cutting short a visit to Greece and returning home to follow ongoing developments.
Well, around the world, there were calls for caution and a de-escalation of tensions. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Geng Shuang said, quote, "We urge all parties concerned, especially the United States, to maintain calm and restraint." And France's Deputy Minister for Foreign Affairs, Amélie de Montchalin, said, quote, "We are waking up in a more dangerous world. Military escalation is always dangerous," end quote. In Germany and Britain, leaders called for restraint, but said the U.S. strike was a reaction to provocations by Iran and that country's Quds force posed a threat. In Pakistan, protesters condemned the U.S. for the attack. And the reaction in the United States ranged widely and often diverged along political lines. Well, on the phone with me now is Catherine Gibson, VOA's congressional correspondent. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome.
This has been described as a seismic event in the Middle East. Catherine, what's been the reaction to Soleimani's killing on Capitol Hill?
Well, that reaction has been swift and, as you mentioned, completely along party lines. As with most things up here on Capitol Hill, you see a sharp divide between support for President Trump's actions on the part of congressional Republicans and then, of course, the criticism that comes from Democrats. And in this case, Democrats think that they have a really strong case on two fronts. One, that Congress was not adequately included in the decision to strike against Soleimani. You know, we have several checks and balances that mean that congressional leadership needs to be consulted on decisions of this magnitude. And second, we're also hearing from Speaker Pelosi and others that this is going to have intense consequences in terms of regional stability in the Middle East. And really, they don't have faith that the Trump administration has really thought out the next steps of this plan and how the U.S. will react. There's a lot of concern on that front up here.
Well, of course, you know, this is seen as one of the most consequential foreign policy actions President Trump has taken so far. And of course, as you mentioned as well, very, very differing opinions on Capitol Hill, depending on who you speak to. Is there anything about this strike that Republicans and Democrats do agree on?
Well, they both agree that Soleimani has been a serious national security threat to the United States for years. And one of the most interesting reactions up here on Capitol Hill is from a former intelligence analyst turned member of Congress, a Democrat, Elise Slotkin, who talked about being in on some of these meetings where both Democratic and Republican presidents of the United States had to weigh the, you know, whether or not they should go against Soleimani, and if they did, what that would mean moving forward. Obviously, those previous presidents discovered that the risks didn't outweigh the benefits of striking against him. whereas President Trump, of course, has decided that it is. And that will be something that we'll be dealing with and playing out with here on Capitol Hill in the weeks to come.
Tell us a little bit, just a little bit more. We don't have too much time, but just some depth here about, you know, some on Capitol Hill talking about a march towards what they're calling an illegal war and talk of reviewing the president's war power authorizations. Is that part of next steps for Democrats?
Absolutely. We actually just heard from Mitch McConnell here on the Senate floor, who said that all senators would be receiving a classified briefing early next week on this issue. And he urged these senators to not speak out on this issue until they had received more information. At about that same time, Senator Tim Kaine, a former vice presidential candidate, said that he would be introducing a war powers resolution in the U.S. Senate. And what that means is that there actually will be a debate on the Senate floor between Democrats and Republicans about where the country goes next in terms of action against Iran. That will be a very, very important debate here on Capitol Hill.
And we'll certainly be keeping our eye on that as well. VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson, there speaking to us. Catherine, thank you so much for your time.
You're so welcome.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. North Korea had promised the United States a so-called Christmas present, which many speculated could be a new missile test. Well, that did not happen. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, in his New Year address, announced he is no longer bound by his self-imposed moratorium on long-range missile and nuclear tests. He also warned of an unspecified, quote, shocking action if the U.S. does not soften its stance on nuclear talks. Well, VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Joe Serencioni, president of the Plowshares Fund, a public grant-making foundation focused on nuclear weapon and conflict resolution, why we have so far yet not seen Kim follow through on these threats.
Well, it's possible they ran into some technical problems, but more likely, Kim Jong-un is leaving the door open to talks with the United States. He threatened a Christmas present. He didn't deliver it. He's now threatening a test of a new strategic weapon in, quote, the near future. But that's not now. It appears that what Kim is trying to do is get what he really needs, some sanctions relief, some security guarantees from Donald Trump, and giving him one more chance to do so. We don't know how long that door may be open. Maybe it's a week, maybe it's the rest of the month, but he does appear to be determined to launch or test a new weapon should the administration fail to respond.
As far as what they might be developing, what do you think it is? They've tested some longer range intercontinental ballistic missile devices in the past. Is that where they're going? Are they going back toward nuclear or what?
It's probably a missile test. I mean, any normal missile program would require many more tests than what they've had so far. They've had three tests of two different kinds of long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles. They could use another one. They've shown that they can get them up in the air, but they really haven't demonstrated they can get them back down. That they have a workable reentry vehicle that can deliver the weapon with accuracy on a target, so you could just do that. There's some speculation that they have a solid fuel missile ready to test. The previous ones have been liquid fueled. These take longer to put on a launch pad and fuel, making them more vulnerable. A solid fuel ICBM would be a mobile capability that would be more threatening to the United States. And there's also some thought that it could be a submarine launch ballistic missile. The ones they've tested so far have been from underwater test barges, but they have a very large submarine under construction. A test from that would be a dramatic advance in North Korea's capability.
Where do you think the U.S. goes here? The U.S. seems to have tried everything, ranging from belligerence at some points and bad relationships between the U.S. and North Korea to so far what the Trump administration has done by, you know, reaching out a hand of so-called friendship.
Well, they've done everything except offer them a reasonable compromise deal. Donald Trump appears to have great confidence in his own ability to get a deal sort of on the fly, one-on-one, in just a meeting with Kim. This clearly hasn't worked, and for good reason. That's not the way you negotiate complex agreements like this. And it's it's also been hampered by infighting. You've had some reasonable people like the current Deputy Secretary of State, Steve Biegun, who has wanted to have a step-by-step approach that North Korea give up a significant amount of its capability in exchange for a significant sanctions relief, and then we build on that. But he's been undermined by John Bolton, now departed, who wanted a Libya-style deal, which is what they presented at the Hanoi summit. That is, North Korea do everything to disarm before we do anything in terms of sanctions relief or security guarantees. The administration appears either unwilling or unable to put forward a reasonable compromise plan. They may be able to mount such an effort in the next couple of weeks, but I wouldn't be optimistic.
Do you think politics enters into either side?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Kim Jong-un has his own internal politics. He's getting pressure from his military, from some of the people involved in the programs for further tests. I mean, they want to see if these weapons work or not. And on the Trump side, he does not want to go to war. So he's looking for steps that can sort of minimize the North Korea threat and therefore minimize any actions he might take in the wake of a test. He's looking at the 2020 election. That's what he cares about more than anything else. So if, and I would say when, Kim does test this weapon, I would expect some rhetoric from Trump, some actions at the lower end of the escalatory ladder, like some new exercises or moving some ships into the area. But I don't think Trump's going to do anything that will provoke a crisis. In situations like this, like the situation with Iran right now, what you're worried about is an unintended consequence. One side thinks they're taking a reasonable step that appears to the other to be highly provocative, and they respond in an unexpected way, and the thing spirals out of control. That's why it'd be so urgent to get talks going again between the U.S. and North Korea.
Joe Cirincione, president of the Plowshares Fund, a public grant-making foundation focused on nuclear weapon and conflict resolution, speaking there to VOA's Ira Melman. Well, one of the largest evacuations in Australia's history is underway ahead of hot weather and strong winds expected to worsen deadly fires raging across the country. More than 200 fires are burning, and warnings of extreme danger to come Saturday prompted mass evacuations. Traffic was gridlocked as people fled, and firefighters escorted convoys of evacuees away from danger areas. Some people were evacuated by Navy ships. Prime Minister Scott Morrison urged people to leave sooner rather than later to reduce the risk.
When people are trying to move in those circumstances, then they're obviously putting themselves at great risk and potentially others as well. So that evacuation effort today is extremely important, and it's had a very big focus.
Well, Morrison was in Bairnsdale, Victoria State Friday to assess the danger.
There are some grueling days ahead, as you all know. What I have been pleased to see here has been the absolute integration of the local efforts together with the state efforts and the efforts of the Australian Defence Force.
Fires raging in several states have destroyed more than 1,400 homes and killed at least 19 people. Millions of wild animals and livestock have also died. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Host Rick Pantaleo speaks with author Amy Webb, CEO and founder of the Future Today Institute, and futurist Mark Palatucci about the latest technological and digital trends for 2020. They will also discuss the role that 9 of the biggest tech companies are playing in the development of artificial intelligence. Listen for it on Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. Thank you also to our director, Dan Brown, and our engineer, PJ Elliott. I'm Haydee Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. Until next time, have a great day.